Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School. Once a month on a Monday, she is here. We talk about women's health. She usually comes prepared to talk about couple of things, and maybe there are things going on in the news that you'll have questions about. And the idea here is that she is a resource for you. Whenever we have physicians on the program, I do try to mention to people that obviously we can't diagnose over the telephone. There are a lot of things that we can't do because the doctor and the various doctors that we have here can't see you, but we do these programs in the hope that we'll add to your health knowledge. And it is a place to start. If you have concerns after that, of course, you need to see your own physician or someone who can indeed see you. But we welcome any and all questions, and I know that she will do her best to give you an answer. If you're listening here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. So you have questions, you give us a call. Glad to have you here. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And we do already, I think, have a caller, or maybe we're getting somebody lined up, so we will get to them in a moment. There are some things that you'd like to talk about this morning?
There was a fascinating story about high heels that I thought I would mention.
Really?
Well, I don't know if you've heard this, but we've often told young women that wearing stiletto heels could lead to knee problems or even hip problems or foot problems, that they're not well designed. And some British researchers actually did a study, and they found that fewer of the very high heel wearers had osteoarthritis, arthritis of the knees. About 50% of heel wearers over the age of 40 had osteoarthritis, whereas in the women with who did not wear stiletto heels, about 65% of them had osteoarthritis of their knees. So actually, wearing very high heels, contrary to what teenage moms may tell their daughters, does not injure your knees. And as you may know, that osteoarthritis of joints is actually a fairly serious problem in the United States today. Many women complain of joint problems, particularly knee problems. And in this particular study, the number one cause of knee problems was being overweight, and overweight prior to the age of 40. So, and they looked also at dancing in high heels. I figure these people are just coordinated, but actually the dancers who could dance in stiletto heels had the fewest knee problems of all.
Really? Well, all right then. Go out and strap on your high heels and go dancing, provided that you can actually manage to
kind of quasi women's health issue.
Yeah, okay.
A little bit fashion, a little bit women's health.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm calling about a situation that my sister is in. She has sort of a severe arthritis in her hip. She's young. She's in her early 30s. And she's considering hip replacement, but she also wants to have children. And so the question is, do you know of anyone who's had a child after a hip replacement?
Well, what you're talking about has actually become more and more common as hip replacement surgeries have become more refined, and as we've discovered that people can very successfully have these hip replacements and lead extremely active lives, or I should even say much more active lives than they were leading prior to their hip replacement. Many women are selecting to have this done younger. And, of course, it's not common for people to have it at such a young age that they haven't yet completed their childbearing. But there are women like your sister who have had pregnancy post-hip replacement. I don't think I've seen any very large series papers where they've looked at large groups of women like this, but more case reports and isolated cases where people have done well. Probably two issues. One's carrying the pregnancy and the other is birthing the pregnancy. And there's no doubt that some hip replacement patients have a little bit of a limited lateral range after the surgery, so that vaginal birth might become a problem in terms of being able to do all the maneuvers that successfully get the pelvic bones the widest they can possibly be. And so there could be situations where a cesarean birth would be recommended. As we've talked about a lot on this show, cesarean births are more and more common, and that wouldn't be that crucial. And then some people, the amount of weight that they gain or some of the posture changes, we tend to, in pregnancy, have what we call more lordosis. So in other words, more arching of the lower back as the center of gravity shifts. And that can create some low back strain. And if you're additionally compensating for other muscle group weaknesses, that could possibly exaggerate that. But nothing that should be prohibitive in terms of getting pregnant.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. And again, other people who are listening, if you have questions for our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, you can call us 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, aside from high heels,
there are actually a number of interesting, and since
things.
I was just talking about cesarean birth, there were a couple of big studies that were released recently that looked at cesarean birth and consequences after cesarean birth. And we've talked that it is possible to have a successful vaginal birth after you do have a cesarean. And then recently, some of the trends have been more and more for patients after one cesarean to more frequently select cesarean than they did for a while. For a while, the trend was completely towards vaginal births. And we used to say statistically about 75% of women after cesarean could successfully have a vaginal birth. And now the trends have been a little bit in the other direction. And there was a new study released that not only is it much more likely for you to have another cesarean after your first compared to women who had other types of delivery, forceps, vacuums, other ways to successfully achieve the same end. Infertility apparently is increased after a cesarean birth, and they don't really yet understand why. The study just looked at the rate of infertility after cesareans in moms, and they don't know for sure. They think there are some psychological components that women are somehow more afraid to even become pregnant because they're worried they may have to have more complicated pregnancy or another surgery. And so the researchers are trying to understand why that is, but apparently it is a real trend.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when we talked about this, having talked about this, I don't know how long, maybe 10 years ago? It was
a long time ago when
the physicians were very concerned. They were looking at the numbers of C-sections, and they were saying that they think, at least some physicians were saying, we think there are way too many. What are the primary reasons today that a woman will have a cesarean?
Well, if you look at the rates of C-section in the 1950s were probably 2-3% of all births got a cesarean section. And in the United States in the past few years, the rate has been hovering right around 24%, and it's creeping up. And you can point to parts of the country where cesarean birth rates are, you know, isolated places where they're over 50%, crazy high rates. And we are not alone. Apparently, the country of Brazil has about a 70% cesarean section rate in their hospitals. That's a little bit of a funky statistic because apparently a certain percentage of the population delivers at home, and they're just not even in the statistics, and that percentage probably obviously has a much higher birth rate, vaginal birth rate. Now, in the United States, primary reasons for cesarean section have been previous cesarean section, breech pregnancy. Pretty much today is almost exclusively treated by cesarean birth, and about 3% of all babies are coming bottom first, so breech. So that's a chunk. And probably the biggest group is in the arrest disorders. And you know, we always have kind of funny terms in medicine that are a little bit hostile sounding, and they're always trying to come up with better terminology so it doesn't sound so terrible. But basically, someone who stops progressing in labor, and we talk about CPD, and that's another thing we do in medicine. We give everything initials. It makes us sound smart. But CPD is cephalopelvic disproportion, and the idea being that the relative size of the baby to the mom's pelvis, it's just not fitting, and it could be tissue reasons, so heavier moms have a little bit more CPD. It could be pelvic. There's certain groups of patients that have much narrower or either narrow from top to bottom or narrow from side to side pelvic dimensions that increase their rate of CPD. So it could be that other arrest disorders could be strictly from the uterus not contracting properly and not getting enough force to progress and open up the cervix. And we've used the medicine Pitocin for many years for this, but now we also have various kinds of prostaglandins, and we've even used misoprostol for this. So we have better medicines for that, but still that whole group of arrest disorders is a big group. And then we've blamed the creeping rate of cesarean birth a lot on a condition called fetal distress or fetal stress or fetal intolerance to labor. And basically, with the advent in the 1950s of the fetal monitor, we discovered that certain babies that were compromised for oxygen would show certain patterns on the fetal monitor. And with that, the idea was that if these patterns come up, you should immediately perform a cesarean birth in hopes of preventing any subsequent damage due to lack of oxygen. Well, this technology was too widely applied. It was never studied in a randomized control fashion before. Everybody just liked the idea and started using all the monitors. So it was probably too widely applied in that basically nobody goes through labor anymore in a hospital without being hooked up to that fetal monitor for a little while. And it was, if anything, overinterpreted. So the idea was that we understand that most of these patterns that could signal distress in the baby usually do not. But the idea is also that we don't want to let any baby labor for too long if one of these patterns comes up. So jumping in early and doing a cesarean birth rather than letting the labor progress is probably another big cause of the increasing rate of C-section since the advent of fetal monitors, which now is more than 50 years ago, but still it's just been an increasing trend.
Yeah. Well, do doctors still think that there are too many?
You know, that's one of those great debates that, you know, you go to a conference of obstetricians and you have a couple of professors up there and they try to not say whether there's too many or not. They try to stand back and say, okay, what is our optimal rate? So let's figure out the optimal rate first, and then do we match it or not? And so then the discussion is, well, what is the optimal rate, for instance, with a breech delivery? It's a very small percentage of babies that would ever get into trouble from a breech delivery. Somewhere's probably between 2 and 3%. So that you're sectioning or performing a cesarean birth on 98%, 97-98% of breaches just to save that 2 to 3%. And of that 2 to 3%, most of the consequences or the harm or the adverse outcomes would be relatively mild. But if you look at the flip side, we've done studies where they've looked at 10,000, 20,000, I think there's been one study where over 30,000 cesarean births were done and there were no actual deaths or serious complications to the mom from the operation. So as the operation has become so much safer due to antibiotics, due to better anesthesia, better surgical techniques, better sutures, all of that, then the so-called ideal has been tipped, because back when cesareans were quote-unquote more dangerous, you would look at that whole formula a little bit more differently.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month on a Monday, she is on this program and answers questions about women's health. If you would like to talk with her, you can do that very easily by calling us here in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. Also, we do have that long distance or that toll-free number if you would be calling long distance, so then the call will be on us, and that is 800-222-9455. Have some other things you want to talk about?
Well, women are always asking about the best method of permanently planning not to have children, and sterilization is often considered. About one-third of couples over the age of 35 in the United States today, either one or the other, has elected sterilization, or actually, to get to that whole one-third, some are involuntarily sterile. But one-third of the couples over the age of 35 in the United States today has sterilization as their primary method of contraception. So it's a very popular method, and couples often seeking advice ask, well, who's it easier for? Is it easier for the guy? Is it easier for the gal? It's definitely cheaper for the male. It probably has been a lesser operation for the male. And now we have a very minor operation for females that can accomplish the same thing. And it's this process called Esure. And there are these little coil micro inserts, very tiny little coils that are inserted through the cervix with a procedure called hysteroscopy by looking inside the uterus and placed in the entrance of the fallopian tube that connects into the uterus. And then they kind of scar into place, and in a couple of months you're essentially sterile after the placement of Esure. So it is a really good new alternative. You don't have to have an incision in your abdomen. We're hoping that it'll bring down costs of tubal ligation. Costs is always such a difficult issue in healthcare, because every little device costs so much, and the device itself costs quite a bit. So you save on one end of the procedure, and you may end up a little bit of cost on the other end. On the other hand, we think that for patients that are obese or severely obese, who their doctors told them that actually performing a tubal ligation might be a more difficult or even potentially risky procedure, this Esure should be a very good alternative for these patients. So it's a new method, and we welcome any new methods of contraception, because we know that in the United States today we still have a fairly high unplanned pregnancy rate, and we want to get additional methods that would satisfy different types of patients so that we can tackle that unplanned pregnancy rate.
What are the possibility that for a sterilization, either for a man or a woman, that it should on its own untie?
Well, with tubal ligations, they have said that there's about 2 to 3 per 1,000 failure rate if you look over 10 years. Now, that's higher than we used to quote, but the initial studies only looked over a year or two. So I think with vasectomies for men, the failure rate's fairly similar, maybe a little bit lower, but fairly similar. Now, these Esures, again, they haven't been around long enough to give 10, 20-year failure rates, but the early studies show them to be extraordinarily effective. In the studies, the way they do it is they do the surgery, and then they wait a couple of months to make sure the scarring of the tube juncture has been accomplished, and then they tell you to go ahead and rely on it after checking that scarring has in fact been accomplished. So perhaps that's the source of the great success, because we usually just do the tubal ligation and shake our patient's hand and say, thanks for your business and
good luck.
Good luck. And fortunately, that's very successful in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
Not all.
And there are also some cases where people have the surgery and then sometime later decide they would like to have it reversed. What's the possibility of
that? Well, and see, and that's a big problem, because the most recent study of regret from tubal ligation procedures is about 1 in 5. 20% regret. Now, when you say a study like that, it's kind of an odd study, because you know they're going around and taking a questionnaire, and patients are doing their best at that moment to answer. And even if they answer regret, would you really go so far as to truly want another baby or to truly pursue having another child? And that's where the number may be a little bit higher than we think. And that's why some obstetrician gynecologists have promoted the use of intrauterine devices, which have the effectiveness of sterilization but are essentially 100% reversible just by removing the device. So you do have to weigh that issue of regret into any sterilization procedure. whether it's going to be easier or harder to remove these inserts. I'm sure they'll be easy to remove if it's within weeks or something like that, because they probably won't be completely scarred in. But the issue of regret with these inserts will have to be looked at, as will the pregnancies and the pregnancy outcomes after these inserts. There have been so few pregnancies worldwide that they don't even have series that they can really quote patients as to the safety of pregnancy with one of those sets of inserts in place.
Mm-hmm. Well, still, it's still the case, though, that if you look at expense and ease of procedure, that vasectomy has still got the edge?
It does. It does, but if you're the female and you want to control your own fertility, a vasectomy doesn't exactly accomplish that.
All right. Well, we're at our midpoint here this morning in this first hour of Focus 580. It's our monthly program talking about women's health, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She's here always on a Monday once a month to talk about women's health. And again, if you have questions, you pick up the telephone and give us a call, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Other things you'd like to talk about?
There also was a new study talking about the use of diet medications in women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, and some of these patients were infertile as well. And actually using the diet medication that's the brand name Meridia actually reduced some of the metabolic, hormonal abnormalities, some of the insulin levels, some of the sugar levels, some of the other hormone levels, and increased patients' ability to get pregnant. So there's real evidence that using a medication can actually be successful in helping an overweight patient achieve a successful outcome to infertility. So that was new and kind of exciting. There's also been a number of new treatments for uterine fibroids. Many years ago, women with uterine fibroids were pretty much offered to either live with their condition or have a hysterectomy. And then we went into an era when we told patients, well, maybe you don't have to have a hysterectomy, but you can have a operation performed called a myomectomy, where we remove the fibroids from the uterus itself. Well, now we're moving more into an era where we're trying to use medication to successfully treat the heavy bleeding or the pain and discomfort with uterine fibroids without having to do hysterectomies in all these patients. And I know we're going to be testing out one of these medicines fairly soon, and we're kind of excited about it.
Okay. Well, again, I just want to make sure that people who are listening know that we're here to answer questions, something that we try to do on a regular basis on the program. Dr. Troopen is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, and we talk a lot about all kinds of different things, just about anything that you could imagine raising with somebody who is in her area of practice. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
There's still a number of women that are decreasing their use of estrogen. With the new Women's Health Initiative information that came out a couple of years ago, and they've had many subsequent publications talking about further analysis of this information, we've assured patients that short-term use of estrogen is quite safe and appropriate for some conditions of menopause that don't respond particularly well to other things, but that long-term use of estrogen is not as safe as we thought it was. And also, in some patients, if you use estrogen in the short term, you're going to just face what you would have gone through
just later
when you try to get off your hormones. And so we're really struggling with that, to try to find the right dose, the right timing, the right way to get off medicine. And I know in the past couple of months, maybe even longer, I've talked a lot about that. We now have an approach where we try to talk to the patient about her individual problems and then treat those individual problems as they may or may not arise. So that, for instance, sleep has often been a complaint of women at the time of menopause. They say studies show you have a longer sleep latency. It takes you longer to fall asleep. And some patients are reporting that it can even take them an hour and a half to fall asleep. And more episodes of awakening and less ability to even get back to sleep once you get awake. And consequences of this sleep deprivation are fairly dramatic in many physical ways as well as emotional and mental ways. So we're really searching for alternatives to hormones to treat the sleep disorders with menopause. And I'm going to be involved in one of those studies as well. So I'm kind of excited about that and looking for some sleepless people in Champaign-Urbana.
Well, do you know, when we've talked about this in the past, you seem to think that, or to say that you felt there would be continuing research in this area of hormonal replacement, and that you thought that it might be possible to design a medicine that would get you the positive benefits that you want without the negative side effects that you don't want. I mean, do you still feel that that's the theory, the idea of hormonal replacement is still good, and that eventually the technical problem will be solved?
Well, absolutely. We have over 47,000 women in the United States today that live to over 100. And so we are living longer, and we want to live well. And we want to live with as much energy as possible. Of course, we want to look young, but we want to feel young. And estrogen had that attractiveness of keeping our skin younger, increasing sex drive, increasing energy levels, making our moods better, making us sleep better. So mood memory was improved. And so absolutely, we're trying to look at ways where we get that perfect designer, either molecule or sets of medicines that can do it. And I don't think we're going to give up on it, because I don't think that there are definitely people out there that can live to over 100, never take a pill in their life. They don't have headaches. They don't have colds. They don't sleep poorly. They do great. And those people are probably thin and exercise a lot and were given the gift of terrific longevity genes from their parents. But for most of the rest of us, we're looking for medicine to help us not only live longer, but live well.
We have a caller here, someone here in Illinois on our toll-free line. Let's go there, line four. Hello.
Yes, I was calling in to ask the doctor. My fiance and I are considering having children. She's had children prior to me. And she had a tubal ligation, and I was wondering about what the prospects of childbearing would be.
Well, of course, there's a couple of issues, and we'll just assume that as a couple, all the infertility is on her part with the tubal ligation, that she was completely healthy prior to having a tubal ligation. It turns out that most tubal ligation procedures are reversible in somewhere between 50% and 70% of the cases. In other words, that the tube itself was probably somewhere between 5 and 6 inches long, and somewhere between 1/2 to 1 inch of tube in the middle has been removed, and the ends have sealed over, and the operation is not so difficult, where the ends of the fallopian tubes can be opened up and they can be rejoined and sewn in a way that they hook up again. And the success rate depends on whether you can get both sides hooked up. The success rate also depends upon whether the rejoining stays open. The success rate also depends upon how much length there's left to the tube itself, because there's a certain distance between the uterus and the ovary that the sperm and egg have to journey. And so the length is apparently important. The function of the fallopian tube after you hook it back up is also important, as once an egg becomes fertilized, it lives in the fallopian tube kind of in like a washing machine kind of effect, kind of swishes back and forth for about 5 or 6 days before it then gets plummeted into the uterus to implant and go on from there. And then there's different issues that have nothing to do with the fallopian tube. So all these things are factors. Some women who've had surgeries end up with scar tissue. I know I've talked about that quite a bit. As one of the other areas of research that I'm pretty interested in is scarring after surgery. And we find that some people who've had a tubal ligation, their distal end of their tube, the fimbriated end that has to wave around, and those are the fingers that have to pick up the ovulated egg, has been either scarred over or somehow damaged in the process of either having the tube ligated or some other procedure. And those things all impact on your ultimate success rate. And it turns out that with the newer technology of in vitro fertilization, that if you use the cutoff of age 35, that after the age of 35, there are other factors that affect whether a woman is fertile or not, and that has to do with her egg quality and the numbers of eggs that she's producing. And when they do studies of success rates from test tube babies and versus reversing the tubes, they find that after the age of 35, even if you go to the trouble of having the tubal reversal operation, some of these other factors become so much more important that physicians should probably, after the age of 35, recommend that a woman consider in vitro fertilization, or the so-called nicknamed test tube baby, rather than a tubal reversal. And so there are a lot of things to consider. And because of this, and because of the age group of people seeking reversals, some of us who used to do a lot of reversal operations, it used to be something that I did. I don't do enough of them anymore, so I pretty much gave up the operation. And there were some other factors, too. Insurance reimbursement's not good for that. It's very expensive operations, so patients find it difficult to pay for anyway. And a few issues like that led to my personal decision as a physician, and I think that I wasn't necessarily alone. So that if somebody is thinking that they've had a tubal ligation and they still want children, they might want to get counseling for in vitro fertilization.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. But you touched on just the question I was thinking about. So it is possible for a woman who's had a tubal ligation to use the in vitro procedure as a way of getting pregnant and after having been sterilized.
Oh, yeah, because the tubal ligation procedures primarily just involve the tube, and the in vitro fertilization procedures involve harvesting an egg out of the ovary. They involve mating that egg with sperm in a dish, typically. There are alternatives. And then placing that fertilized egg, which has now become a hopefully healthy embryo, inside the uterus to complete its growth and go on to become a full-term pregnancy.
Okay. Well, again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You have some other things on your list?
Well, also with our menopausal patients that are trying to switch off of estrogen, we've talked a little bit about what's the best way to go to prevent hormonal symptoms, but the other issue is what's the best way to go to protect your bones. And this is another really big issue. The strategy used to be one of universally recommending that women do something to preserve their bone mass, the idea being that everyone will lose bone mass as they age, which is still somewhat true. The idea being that if you drop below a certain threshold of mass, that you increase your risk for fractures. And again, that is somewhat true. And it's more true for older patients than younger patients, in terms of what their immediate fracture risk is. And the idea that if you sustain the best bone mass that you can for as long as you can, that if and when your bone mass starts to drop, that you're dropping from a higher point. So that basically the philosophy used to be give everyone some sort of medicine, and of course all we had to begin with was estrogen. And now the philosophy is pretty much switched, and we're saying that we want to treat people who are at most risk for osteoporosis. We want to treat people who have low bone mass. And also, after women go off of estrogen, they need to understand that they need to have their bone mass tested Because if it was good when you were on estrogen, in the next 6 months to a year, some of that bone mass is going to drop. Almost for sure it will drop. And the question is, without being tested, you don't know how much it's going to drop. And then beyond that, the next big scientific question is, then what do you do? If you were on estrogen, you've gone off, and now you have low bone mass, what is the best next step? Is it getting back on estrogen? Is it going to a bisphosphonate like the Actonel or Fosamax we've talked before? Is it going to a selective estrogen receptor modulator, these new designer molecules? They're designed to act like estrogen in some tissues, not like estrogen in other tissues. So that's where a lot of research right now in women's health is being concentrated, trying to determine what is the best direction to go. And it's really not a simple decision for women stopping their estrogen. It's probably something fairly complex that they may want to talk to their healthcare provider about.
Okay. We have another caller here. This listener is in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had a question about Pitocin during during labor. I've got a 9-year-old daughter who has had behavior problems sort of throughout her school career. She also is tested as being exceptionally gifted. So there's sort of like this two-edged sword going on. We've had to look into it, and every place we've been kind of around the country and doing our research, the first question that comes up from the psychologists and psychiatrists is, was there Pitocin involved? And then we say, well, yeah, for about 2 days. And they kind of say, oh. And then they don't really say anything more. What is there something going on there that...
Well, that's a pretty complicated question. In the most simplistic form, sometimes we don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg. Was it an obstructed extra long labor that needed Pitocin that caused some patients to be exposed to very long labors that could potentially have some outcomes that are adverse, like what you're talking about in terms of neurologic outcomes, or was it just the Pitocin medicine itself? It's when they do research studies on risk markers, Pitocin crops up as a potential risk marker. Now, I've talked about this before in terms of medical research, and that's the difference between a risk marker and a risk factor. And a risk factor is something that we know produces disease. We know that the human papillomavirus, certain types of human papillomaviruses lead to cancer. They're risk factors. You have that, you might get a cancer from it. There's other kinds of things like increased sexual behavior, lots of different partners that probably doesn't cause cervical cancer, but if you look at cervical cancer patients, they're statistically more likely to have that. So we call that a risk marker. But there's nothing necessarily biologic about these partners that would change things that we've proven, unless you pick something up. So hopefully that's a good analogy. In terms of behavior and neurologic phenomena, it's so complicated because when you read these studies, first of all, most patients who are given Pitocin have very healthy children without any adverse consequences. Secondly, many patients with adverse neurologic consequences never did have an obstructed labor. So we know that it can't be the only risk factor, but sometimes labor does lead to some compromise of the oxygen going across the placenta, so that when the uterus contracts, the main blood vessels that supply the placenta contract as well, and they don't have as much blood flow across them, so not quite as much oxygen goes across. So that what's happening to a fetus in labor is it's going through these short bursts of holding its breath. And most of us have done that. Most of us were exposed to the process of labor, and we had no adverse neurologic outcome. But apparently, longer labors could decrease some of the oxygen flow. So you wonder if, in fact, that could lead to some sort of adverse outcome. And I think that when people treat children with neurologic compromise of any kind, they try to look at all different factors, and they look for trends, and they try to look for explanations, and they're fascinated by the subject. Maybe that's where they get the "oh" comment from. But really, there is no literature out there that says that Pitocin is unsafe for laboring or pregnant moms or children. Pitocin can be a terrific drug and used wisely, as it's probably being used in this town as we speak, because it's a very commonly used medication in labor. So I wouldn't want any listeners out there to think that, in fact, Pitocin in any way is unsafe. And really, in a case like yours, there's probably no way to establish what the cause of her behavior problems were. I mean, we can look at medicines her mom took. We can look at family life stresses. We can look at things she ate. I mean, we can look at all kinds of different factors, and yet we don't really. We can look at all kinds of different issues that are probably risk markers, but knowing what the true risk factor is has eluded us most of the time.
Okay. What they had been telling us was that kids with these specific attributes that we're dealing with, it wasn't just, oh, you know, you got this behavior problem kid, and we see a lot of that with Pitocin. It was sort of more specific to this, what they're calling twice exceptional, which is gifted with some deficits, some fairly marked deficits in very specific behavior areas. And we started, and they're the ones that are sort of saying, you know, we're just seeing a lot of our kids that we're seeing. This is kind of like a national center in Denver that we're dealing with. They said, you know, it's really been interesting. And they told us there's no evidence yet. We've just been watching this. And there are people doing studies, and they're starting studies to try to find out what's going on here, because they said statistically there are these kids that present with these problems. They were saying from the psychological side, there's a significantly high degree of these kids that had longer use of Pitocin. In our case, it was our daughter was getting quite large, and my wife didn't seem to have any interest in delivering, and so it was sort of a really low dosage, 2 or 3 day drip that was used to try to kick her into labor. And eventually, after about 3 days, she did go into labor and delivered fairly quickly. So I don't know. And the other question I guess that I had was, over a 2 day thing like that, where I don't know how common that is. It seemed like it was sort of something that we collectively came up with the physician to try to do this slow, because we were resisting it. Would that be considered labor? I mean, physiologically, what's going on when that drip is starting and they're trying to just induce labor? Because there really wasn't any sign of labor. I mean, my wife was in the hospital for 2 or 3 days just sort of sitting there watching TV, and like everything was just fine. So we were trying to start labor. I don't know that she was in, I don't know if that's considered in labor for 2 or 3 days, or was it just the 30 minutes that she went, uh-oh, and 30 minutes later we had our daughter.
We divide labor into different stages, and the first stage of labor, which is from the time the mom's first starts to when she's completely dilated, then gets further divided into an inactive and an active phase. And the active phase usually kicks in somewhere around 4 centimeters of dilatation up to the full 10 centimeters when now you can push and you become in the second stage. Just for listeners that are listening, third stage is getting rid of the placenta. But that first inactive stage in patients having first babies spontaneously, usually it's about 20 hours, something like that. Second babies typically can be 12. And the first part of that is very very inactive. The mom may not feel anything. But the definition of labor is progressive effacement, which is thinning and opening of the cervix. So the part that she was sitting around getting medicine without cervical change, by definition, is not labor. Now, does it have some consequences? You're contracting. Is that different than not contracting? Sure, that would be. Also now, we have better medicines and better techniques of getting patients to get through that stage more rapidly than the thing that you're describing with using Pitocin in a low dose over several days, which does work and was considered standard of care and is still used in the United States today. But there are better medicines that we can accomplish the same thing in a shorter amount of time. And the flip side is that if you're accomplishing the same thing in the shorter amount of time, your contractions are going to be a lot more uncomfortable a lot sooner. Mm-hmm. So people perceive it as a harder labor.
I see. Great. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's in here with us once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
Well, we talk a lot about breast cancer on almost every show, and we talk a lot about breast cancer rates in different populations, and I think we've talked before about the fact that Asian women, particularly Japanese women, have a much lower rate of breast cancer than American women, particularly those living in their native country. And there has always been a suspicion that it was due to the soy in their diet and different overall estrogen levels in their bodies. And we've also talked about other ways that you can eat healthy to avoid cancers. And I don't think we've come up with the magic perfect diet for everyone. And I'm sure everybody agrees on that. But it's kind of interesting because a new study looked at both black and green teas as well as soy in the Asian diet. And in fact, they did find that increased consumption of both black and green teas were statistically related to lower breast cancer rates. Now, again, this is at that risk marker stage, not necessarily risk factor stage. With soy, we think that it's been biologically proven that it can very high soy intakes can reduce your risk of breast cancer. It's a little too soon to really give full credit to black and green teas, but it's another reason, and we've talked about other reasons that black and green tea are generally healthy for patients and associated with reduced cancer rates. But they were looking in this study specifically at reducing breast cancer rates. So maybe there's another thing that you can do positively is increase your consumption of black and green tea.
I wonder if I could ask you, I'm just, you know, how I look around for things to ask you about when you're on the show, about a recent study that has to do with how do you tell if you're approaching menopause? That and my sort of my understanding, and based on what we talked about in the past, is if you ask, okay, how close is woman coming? Because the average age is 50, one of the predictors we say, okay, well, how close are you to 50? The other thing is, obviously, if you start having symptoms, like if you start having hot flashes, you know, that's a sign. One of the things that the main thing that this study found was that for a woman to have missed a period turned out to be in their study and actually a better predictor than either of the other things. They found that skipping a period over the preceding year was associated with undergoing menopause within 2 years for 65% of the women, and then within 4 years for almost all of them. So they seem to be saying, okay, well, if you kind of want to know where you are you getting close? What they seem to be saying is that skipping a period, of course, assuming that it doesn't mean that you're pregnant, skipping a period is actually a pretty good predictor that within the next couple of years.
Well, I was looking, I think I saw that press release and I haven't seen the actual study. So I was kind of curious because the third thing besides what is your actual age and are you having any symptoms? The third thing we always ask is, what age was your mom when she went through menopause? And I didn't know if that was factored into that study. The other thing is, of course, in the United States, a lot of people are on birth control pills, and birth control pills are artificially bringing on your periods in a very regular fashion. So that certainly wouldn't be predictive in that group. And also, there's a big percentage of patients that already had fairly irregular periods leading up to this point in time. And I think that study pretty much was targeting people who were very regular going into this point in time. So I think if you whittle down to that group where you've been extremely regular and now all of a sudden you've skipped a period or two, yes, I think that that you can start feeling like it's a sign of menopause. And the other issue is, should you care, should you not care?
Yeah.
If you're asymptomatic, well, maybe you shouldn't care one way or the other. Certainly if you're trying to have a last baby and you're 43 and you've always been regular and now you're skipping a little bit and you want to know a little bit more about your ovarian reserve, now I think this study is more helpful and those patients can maybe think twice and say, okay, maybe I'm going to go through menopause a little prematurely. We call anything from the age 45 to 55 natural. And the actual statistical age of menopause is 51.4.
Oh, okay.
51.4. And it's the same in every population. And really the only thing a woman can do to make that come on earlier is be a smoker. Hmm. Smokers go through earlier menopause.
Well, I think we'll have to wrap it up because we come to the end of the time. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here. Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she's an obstetrician and gynecologist, has a practice in our area. She teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign once a month. Always on a Monday, she is here, and we talk about women's health.